From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made in the year 2050, when New York could be free of greenhouse gas emissions. To quote the New York Times, lawmakers are envisioning an era when gas-guzzling cars, oil-burning heaters, and furnaces would be phased out, and all of the state's electricity would come from carbon-free sources, end quote. That's the goal of the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which the state legislature passed in 2019. Specifically, it aims to establish limits on the statewide emissions of greenhouse gases, 40% by the year 2030, 85% by 2050, with a zero economy by 2050. It's one of the most ambitious and aggressive climate action bills in the nation. Consider it New York State's climate law. Well, that law sets the state's objective. But how do you do it? Where will the funding come from to make some significant changes? Some lawmakers are hoping to answer those questions with the Climate and Community Investment Act. Supporters say this is going to create hundreds of thousands of jobs. It's going to protect workers currently in the fossil fuel industry and support the communities most impacted by climate change and pollution. So how? Well, two pieces are a climate pollution fee and an energy rebate for households and small businesses. Another piece is an increase on taxes on gasoline and home heating. Critics of the bill are pushing back against those taxes, specifically the gas tax. A lot of what you will hear in response opposed to this is about the gas tax. New Yorkers have decisions to make regarding how to address the climate crisis. Is the Climate and Community Investment Act the way to do it? Our guests this hour are here to explain why they have come out in support of all this. They explain it and the possible impact. In the future, we will welcome guests who have trouble with it, and that tends to be Republicans, conservatives, some in state government. So you're going to hear multiple conversations about this particular legislation and the effort coming up. Let me welcome our guests who are with us this hour. Liam Smith is co-director of governmental affairs for the New York Youth Climate Leaders. Liam, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me today.
Eric Koski is the owner and principal of Orbed Analytics, LLC, and volunteer with Climate Solutions Accelerator of the Genesee Finger Lakes region. And among many other titles, Eric, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Glad to be here. Thank you very much.
Alan Blair, Dr. Blair, is a liaison to NY Renews, New York Renews, from the Rochester chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby. Alan, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
John Kievert is a volunteer with New York Renews Organizing Committee and the Climate Solutions Accelerator and a retired photographic scientist. John, welcome to you. Thank you for being with us.
Again, thank you for having us.
And I'm going to bring in a member of the New York State Assembly for the first part of the hour. Sarah Clark is with us. Assemblymember Clark, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me, and excited to be among these esteemed experts on climate policy. So,
well,
thank you.
I know your time is limited. Let's get right to what the legislature is working on here and why you're supporting this. So kind of give me the overview for what you see in specific mechanisms to get some of these goals done here, Sarah.
Sure. You know, as I've mentioned before, I spent the last 20 years working as a staffer in the United States Senate. I think climate policy on the federal level is also desperately needed. But through that role, had the opportunity to meet with so many amazing people who are really trying to do exactly what you said in your introduction, which is so many people have these goals to move to renewable, to get off carbon, but how do we get there? What do we do? And in those meetings, for me, I think it was a couple of years ago, there was a high school student from Brighton who the disappointment in his eyes when he sort of looked at me and as a whole, my generation, to sort of say, why have you done nothing this whole time? We have the solutions. We have ideas. We know what we need to do. Why has nothing been done? Like, it was almost like this like letdown of my, particularly my generation. And I see it in my three children today who, you know, they're ready to do what they can to protect our world and our planet and our state and all the things that come with that, and ask those same questions. Why has nothing more been done to this point? So now here I am in the State Assembly. As you mentioned, in 2019, we passed a very ambitious plan that sets out these goals to really get to net zero on carbon emissions and completely renewable for electricity. But how do we get there? So The Climate and Community Investment Act is that proposal. It does what we need it to do. It makes polluters pay, and it protects the people in our state. And you mentioned the gas tax, which is often what comes up in my emails and what people respond as negative. It's not a direct gas tax. It's a charge to polluters for their emissions and the companies who supply those, and they may pass that on in cost at the gas pump, but it is not a direct tax. Per gallon, or what we normally think about gas tax. And at the same time would create a huge rebate program to make sure that those in our state are, you know, the thing I always hear is if you got a rebate check from either of our federal stimulus plans, then you are going to get a rebate check here. And your rebate check is going to far outpay for any increase in costs beyond what you're already paying now. So in some ways, it's actually a better win. And we're finally moving to the point where we're meeting our ambitious goals and addressing climate change head on.
So when it comes to the gas tax, I just want to make sure we understand here. Because you're right, we get the same kind of emails you do. And we are going to talk to some of your colleagues in the New York State Senate, like Senator Rob Ort, Senator Pam Helming, who have said they hear all the time they're opposing this on the grounds that these taxes would be bad for New York State, bad for individuals. And so can you explain when you say the gas tax is not on individuals? Explain.
Right. So it's a pollution. It's almost like those who are bringing in importing fossil fuels into New York State would pay an increased fee for doing that. Would they then turn around and pass that fee on to the consumers at the pump? Maybe. We don't know. But the point is, even if they do, we are going to offset that with the rebates to the families that will pay that at the pump, right? It's not going to be a direct tax that we collect that comes into the state coffers. It may be something that these companies choose to pass along in that way, but we just don't know the answer. I think one of my frustrations has been is this is ambitious, right? The cost of doing nothing far outweighs the cost of doing something here. I mean, it's going to be catastrophic for our community, our planet, everything if we choose to do nothing. So if we're going to do something, it's big. It's got to be big. We got to redo the whole system in terms of what we and that involves economics, right? So we have to make polluters pay, but we have to protect the people at the same time, which is exactly what the CCIA does.
Yeah, and I mean, history tells us that they're going to pass this cost on. I mean, I take the point that it's up to them, but history tells us they will.
Right.
So when you talk about the rebate, how does it work?
So basically, it would work based on your income, same as stimulus checks. It would be a very and how you receive it will vary because those who are probably our lowest income folks, we don't want to risk them losing or getting any kind of money that risks losing their SNAP benefits or housing vouchers or anything like that. So there will be different mechanisms to how you get the rebate. But for most folks, it'll be around $1,100, a little bit more outside of a little bit more than that for those of us who live in upstate New York. And that alone, if there was a 55 cents increase per gallon, would pay for 2,100 gallons a year, which we typically use around 400. So the rebate would far outweigh any cost increase that is passed along to consumers. And that's the goal. The other piece of this is to invest in communities and invest in workers, workforce development, and protecting those in our current labor, the industry that most would be affected by this policy.
And the last point on that, I always want to compare apples to apples, and I know there's nuance and there's shades of difference here. But the kinds of emails I get about some of, for example, the taxes, people point to what happened in France, where there were public protests and significant pushback. They're essentially saying, you do that here, you're going to get the same thing. Does the rebate sort of blunt that? Do you think the France comparison is a fair one, Sarah?
I mean, I think we are always learning, right? I think the my biggest frustration is either, as you can probably attest to, is a lot of these emails do only tell one side of the story or have some information, which your experts, the rest of the hour, will definitely be able to dive deep into on the weeds there. But, you know, the problem is that we are targeting an industry that has profited for years, both economically and, unfortunately, at the expense of our environment. And we need to do something. But they're going to fight back. They're going to fight back with misinformation. They're going to give talking points and try to scare people. And we have to be ready with our talking points and our facts to make sure that We are addressing those head on. But I also want to say it doesn't mean that anything is perfect, and we do need solutions. And I always have an open door to say, how can we do this better? What ideas do you have? Are there going to be unintended consequences? Where can we make sure we're protecting people at the same time?
And finally, when it comes to the kinds of future that we talked about, that this bill sort of ambitiously lays out and that the New York Times talked about, an era where gas-guzzling cars, oil-burning heaters, furnaces are phased out. We're talking 2050. Are we living in that world realistically in this state? I mean, do you see that? Do you see that even sooner? And I'm not, you know, at all belittling it. I mean, I think I would hope a lot of people do want us there eventually. It's a question of how feasible it is to make that transition. What's the timeline that you see possible, Sarah?
Well, I think it obviously these are ambitious goals, but once we start implementing, you would hope that industry wouldn't drag their feet, that they would jump on board. I mean, we already have a Ford F-150 all-electric ready to be out there at some point soon, as was announced by Ford. Things like that are, you know, we don't want people to have to change dramatically the way if they want a pickup truck, great. I want them to still be able to get one. And there is no better one than an F-150. But that is the hope, right, that industry will come along and see that we are moving there. How can they be a partner with us to push forward? The beauty is we have the science. We have the technology. We have good ideas. But you need that economic incentive to push it forward. And that's what we critically need to do if we're going to make these goals by 2050.
Well, and I'm glad you bring up, you know, sort of the Ford F-150 example. I think there is a kind of culture war distraction that happens in conversations about climate where, you know, people say, well, you know, Joe Biden doesn't want you to be able to order a hamburger or Democrats in New York State don't want you to have a truck. But realistically, if people are going to have trucks in the future, you know, they're just going to be, as you say, maybe perhaps powered differently. But are you finding that the culture war sort of seeps into this? Does that make it more difficult to sort of explain to people what you are trying to do or not trying to do or what you're not trying to take away?
It does. I mean, we feel it in pretty much everything these days, but any huge piece of policy like this is definitely going to have some divisions amongst it that sort of go along either party lines or culture lines or class lines or whatever, where people have put their line in the sand. But for me, what I've seen, you know, if you think of who tends to be on what side of some of these things, is our farmers. They are under extreme duress because of climate change and a changing world, and it's affected them in so many different ways. The floods of 2019, the floods of 2017 were so damaging economically to our communities along the lakeshore and various places. Superstorm Sandy and the catastrophic and billions of dollars of damage that did in New York City. Like, we're paying for it in one way. Our farmers, who you traditionally think of as the salt of our earth, as I do, are, you know, reeling from this. And we need to, you know, sort of bring everyone together to have conversations around this and not use scare tactics and find solutions for everyone.
As I let you go, I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but I've got one more quick one for you. So just the nature of this conversation, we're going to spend the rest of the hour with those who are supporting this effort. On a future program, we will talk to those who have raised concerns. And then I hope eventually maybe we can get, you know, Senator Ort or Senator Helming and people like yourself and others who can at least share their concerns or ideas publicly and clear up maybe some misunderstandings. Would you come back and do that with us sometime?
Absolutely. Would welcome the opportunity.
I always appreciate that. And Sarah Clark has been doing that since the moment she was elected and then some. And we appreciate it. Thank you very much, Assembly Member Clark. Always nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
Sarah Clark, member of the New York State Assembly, explaining the legislative side of things and why she is not only supporting this, but where some of these resources go. And so as we turn back to the panel, you know, I'm just going to put one more fine point on, because I already have emails on the question on the taxes. The proceeds of the tax increase on gas, for example, would go to the development of green energy initiatives. It would spend money on community groups to help withstand climate change. It would give energy rebates to low and moderate income families. And if you're wondering, if you just heard Assemblymember Clark and thinking, well, why give people these big rebates if the rebate is bigger than their typical annual gasoline bill? Why charge the companies and why sort of reroute the money? Well, the point of the legislation is to say we want the money in the hands of the people, not necessarily in the hands of companies that are sort of bringing the inertia and the status quo when it comes to energy production. That is a strategic decision. Economists tell you that is one way to try to move action. And the question is, will it be successful? I want to turn to our guests now. And let me start with Liam Smith, who we've had many conversations on this program on these kinds of issues. How significant do you find this particular piece of legislation, Liam, and how realistic are you finding its sort of enactment and success in the future here?
Hi, Evan. I think this is one of the most important pieces of legislation, climate legislation, in the state legislature right now. Obviously, we have the CLCPA, which mandates we have to be carbon neutral by 2050, but we lack a funding stream, and with the budget fights every year, we really need to make sure we lock down a funding stream to make that happen. And charging, polluters is a way to both get that funding stream and to hold polluters accountable in a manner that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So this bill will turbocharge our efforts to become carbon neutral, and I think it's one of the most important things in order to achieve the CLCPA's goals. How realistic is it? I think it's looking more and more realistic every day. We have a lot of support for this bill. I think last time I checked, and the numbers could be more at this point, we had 29 co-sponsors, so almost a majority of co-sponsors in the Senate. And we are at 40-something co-sponsors in the Assembly, which is almost a third of the Assembly. We have a lot of legislative support for the bill, and every day we get more co-sponsors. So I don't know if it's going to happen this year, but if it doesn't, we're going to make it happen next year.
Let's ask the rest of our guests how they see sort of the landscape with this right now. Eric Koski, go ahead.
Yes, to me it seems really not only realistic but really vitally needed. We know that it's going to take a considerable investment of resources in order to create a transition to renewable energy in New York State, and this bill really does that in the best possible way. Both by pricing carbon, it creates an incentive for everyone to move to renewable sources of energy, but it also invests much of the revenue in making it easier for people to do so. Many people have opportunities already, for instance, to save money on utility bills by moving to electric heating, heat pumps, which also efficiently air condition during the summer. The problem is that it requires a considerable upfront investment. This bill will help people make that investment so that they come out ahead in the end. So that's one good example.
All right. John Kievert, how do you see it?
I think the bill is vital also. Climate scientists are now telling us that we need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by about 45% by 2030 in order to achieve the goals of not exceeding 1.5 degrees C. And that's going to take very much targeted, aggressive investment in renewable energy sources. So we can't wait for the market forces to gradually get around to make that change. We have to invest the money right now to get those offshore wind and community solar, those kind of things, on up and going, so they'll be online by 2030. So it's vital that we do that, and I think it's totally appropriate to make polluters pay to do this, because they've been getting the profit from this for decades. And it's the fee that we've come up with, $55 a ton of carbon, is approximately what brings the total social cost of carbon into a more realistic range. We get carbon really cheap these days, mostly because it doesn't the price at the pump does not cover the problems that carbon brings in health, pollution, even wars that we've had to fight to keep the supply of gas flowing. So it's appropriate to charge it, and we are taking care of the lower 60% of our population that might be impacted by the increased fees by the rebate program. So the rebate program is structured so that those folks will break even or come out ahead. The cost of natural gas will also go up a little bit. So I think it's more likely to be about even for many people.
Before I turn to Dr. Blair, let me just follow the point you're making there, John. Because as I said to Assemblymember Clark, I can't tell you how much communication I've gotten from people who are saying that we're going to have our own version of, and I'm not a French speaker, the Gilets Jaunes, the yellow vest protests in December 2018. And it was largely a massive public sort of pushback against gas taxes, gas, diesel taxes. It forced French President Emmanuel Macron to suspend that tax increase and then to raise the minimum wage. And I bring it up, John, because if the energy companies are able to reroute the economic pain to individuals, then I suspect you could see that here. Now, I know that this bill is, it seems to have taken that into account with the rebate. But people are going to have to believe that and understand it, because they will probably see prices at the gas pump go up, and they will see other prices go up. And if they are not connecting it to a rebate, then they're going to feel like they've been targeted individually, whether it's true or not. Do you see it that way?
Well, I really appreciate your having us on this show now to explain it, because New York Renews has had major focus on getting the word to legislators and hasn't done as good a job as we should have reaching out to the general public. The fossil fuel companies are very much like the tobacco industry was a few decades back. They know their product harms people, and they're putting out as much false narratives as they can in order to keep maximizing their profits for as long as possible. Hopefully we'll break through with the information we need, and people will see that it's long-term benefit. And as Sarah said, the cost of doing nothing is even greater.
Dr. Blair, what do you think?
I agree with John, especially. I wanted to point out that the fossil fuel industry has done a very good job of externalizing its costs. The cost of pollution and of the carbon dioxide that we've been spewing out into the atmosphere are very high, and they've gotten off scot-free so far. As a physician, I can tell you about the health costs alone, which, if you calculate them all out, exceed the amount of money that we will have to pay to make the fossil fuel industries stop polluting. For example, in New York State, the average admission for asthma is $14,000. There are thousands of hospital admissions. There are hundreds of deaths related to pollution, fossil fuel pollution in New York State. Add to that the cost of hospitalization for heart disease, for cancers of all kinds, for COPD, and then the lost wages, and then the lost income from early death. We're talking a huge amount of money, and that will all go away if we can get rid of fossil fuel pollution. The hospitalizations for asthma will decrease immediately within a couple of years. The COPD admissions and the heart disease admissions will drop. Within a decade, the cancer admissions will drop. We'll be a much healthier society, and we will end up paying a lot less on our health care. That's just my example right there.
Okay, and Dr. Blair, if you're making the case to, for example, Republican lawmakers who, you know, we hope to have join us on this program soon, and certainly in the interest of fairness to them, and frankly, many constituents. I mean, there's, you know, they represent districts that probably would align pretty closely with them, generally speaking, on some of these. What is the most important points you would want to press with, you know, sort of in the room with them, or the ways that you would address some of their concerns?
Okay, you're talking about basically income and costs. Well, Eric has done some great modeling on this, and as he pointed out, the majority of people in the state are going to come out ahead money-wise in terms of how much they pay versus how much they get back in the rebate. And Eric was also quite right that for people who don't qualify for the rebate, which is significantly less than half of the population, there is going to be a lot of incentive to switch over to electric heating and electric transportation, both of which are cheaper and more reliable than the current fossil fuel systems that we're dealing with now. The upfront costs are the real barrier, as Eric pointed out. And so this is going to make everyone better off in the long run. I would venture to say that the folks on the Republican side here are discounting the costs of pollution. Do they really believe that there is going to be problems in the future? Are they ready to admit that not doing anything now is going to be far worse for our economy and our state than making needed but costly investments now in order to prevent far worse costs and far worse catastrophes in the future?
Listeners, if you've got questions on this, we're going to try to answer as many as we can this hour and in the weeks to come here, because what we are talking about is really the framework that could end up lasting decades in this state into a significantly transitioned future on energy. And let me go ahead and take the first question. This comes from Keith in Farmington. Hi, Keith. Go ahead.
Evan, how are you doing today?
Good, sir.
This might be slightly off topic. I got a quick question and a comment. If everybody switched to electric cars tomorrow, how would we pay for roads and bridges?
Okay, if we all switch to electric cars tomorrow.
Tomorrow, we all drove them. Because right now, roads and bridges are ostensibly paid for by taxes on gasoline.
All right, so
my wife drives a Tesla, and she doesn't pay for anything other than when she's on the thruway.
Why don't you stay with us there, Keith, and we'll see what our guests have to say. I'll go down the list. Liam Smith, do you want to start?
Sure. So if we switch to electric cars, how are we going to pay for roads and bridges? Well, I guess in terms of the CCIA, this is going to generate $15 billion annually, and like a third of it or something is about 30 to 33% of it is going to be spent on infrastructure projects, which I think will include a lot of, things like building out renewable energy, but other infrastructure as well. I'm not sure how using an electric car would, stop I'm not sure what the relationship you think there is between electric cars and the infrastructure, but I think this bill will generate a lot of money that could be spent on infrastructure. And something else that I just want to mention is that, this is also a jobs bill. It's not just let's tax polluters. It's also estimated to generate 160,000 jobs, good paying union jobs, in just the first year. So this would be a great bill for our New York State economy.
But a quick question: my wife drives a Tesla, a Model 3. It's 4,400 pounds. She right now it's plugged in the garage to fill it up, and I'm using air quotes to put 75 kilowatts from zero through RG&E runs about $9.50, which is pretty good. And she gets about 300 miles on it, but she drives on the roads. She creates potholes and everything, drives over bridges, but she's not paying anything for them. I drive a car, and I buy gasoline, and I pay a tax on it. So what I think should be addressed immediately is how do electric car owners pay for the ability to drive on the road?
Well, okay, so
push down.
I mean, Keith, I'm going to let the panel jump in and answer this, but like the first thing that comes to mind for me is, the premise of your question was if we all switch to doing what your wife's doing tomorrow, what would the state do? And we're not going to do that. I mean, even if our guests had, were able to snap their fingers and that's what we all did tomorrow, that ain't going to happen. And so this state does have time to figure out a way to reroute funding to pay for infrastructure, doesn't it, Keith?
Well, but it should be thought about, it should be brought up immediately because,
sure,
EV sales are going up every month.
Yeah, okay, that's fair enough. So what you're simply asking is, are we doing the work in advance to say one of the unintended consequences is a former source of revenue for infrastructure could be gone? What are we going to do about that?
Very good, Evan.
Okay, fair enough. Keith, thank you. Go walk your dog. Let me have our other guests jump in here, and I'll just go down the list as well. Dr. Blair, you want to take some of that?
Yeah. What we're talking about is a funding mechanism. The state will just use a different funding mechanism. The Climate Action Council, which is actually working now in the state to establish the means by which the CLCPA will carry out its orders is doing stuff like that all the time. They're constantly thinking about these issues and contracting out to various people to come up with these ideas. So that idea is going to be worked out. We're just talking about a different funding mechanism. That's very straightforward.
Okay. John Kievert, how do you feel about that?
Well, you have to think about the time scale. I mean, General Motors is talking about switching over to only electric vehicles by 2035. So that we have a massive fleet of hundreds of millions of cars out there now that burn gasoline, and they don't all go away. So it's going to be a gradual transition. In the short run, I could recommend that people support President Biden's infrastructure bill, which will indeed deal with roads and bridges on the short run that we have been neglecting for decades. On long term, we do need to come up with a new funding mechanism for maintaining the roads. But that's quite a bit down the road from what we're dealing with right now.
And one more, Eric Koski. Go ahead, Eric.
Yes, I know people are already working on this, and concepts have been proposed for raising revenue based on vehicle miles traveled and vehicle weights, some formula incorporating those. I think we're going to find that electric vehicles actually, in a lot of ways, create less wear and tear on the roads than fossil-fueled vehicles do.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And Keith, I do want to thank you for your call. I mean, a listener named David sent us essentially the same kinds of questions. He closed by saying, our electric grid needs to have significant updates to both accommodate the increasing demand and prevent future brownouts. And, all of that is what our guest's saying, that there is time and a way to divert, sort of create a new way of funding. So, Keith, you're right. I mean, these considerations have to be made. And it sounds like our guests are not only making those considerations, but Assemblymember Clark, I think, and her colleagues are going to have to do that. And they say that part of the shifting revenues will allow them to do that. I want to get another question on the other side of this break from email, and we'll come right back with our guests here who are talking to us about climate legislation that could significantly change this state. I mean, permanently. We're talking about real change in how we access energy and how to do it, to get away from just sort of the theoretical and to actually put this in motion to get this done in this state. And our guests will tackle more of the questions on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, a report from Rock the Future revealed that only 5 out of every 10 kids in the city of Rochester feel like they matter to people in this community. Statistics like this inspired teenagers from across the Finger Lakes region to come together and create a new magazine addressing mental health issues. We talk with the teens behind this project and professionals in the field on the importance of mental health literacy and education. Talk with you Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Every time I talk to someone who has traveled overseas, usually Europe, but not always, they say something like, oh my gosh, if we only had the mass transit like they do there. Why do we not do that? Why have we not built that? But then I talk to conservative lawmakers. There's very little appetite for that. There is disdain for the idea that it is sustainable and something you could be paid for. And Jane in Rochester has some thoughts on that next on the phone. Go ahead, Jane.
Well, Evan, since it touches the lives of so many people, I'm thinking mass transit, will it improve or will we decrease with that? I can't see us having less of it. And so I just wanted to ask that question. How will we handle it? Will it be electric buses, double-decker buses, or more shuttles? Do they have any ideas about that? I thank you very much, and I'm enjoying the program.
Well, thank you, Jane. I appreciate that. Liam Smith, we'll start with you there. What do you think?
So I think it broke up a little bit. It's a question about mass transit in the CCIA.
Yeah, I mean, whether it is, whether it is sort of light rail or just electric buses, different ways of providing mass transit that would be more energy efficient, but certainly more accessible.
Yeah, no, that's a really important piece of the puzzle here in terms of, reducing transportation emissions. Transportation is one of the largest sources of emissions in New York State. And the bill, it allocates about a third of it, as I mentioned earlier, about a third of the proceeds to large-scale infrastructure projects. And one of the things included in that is these sort of, high-speed rail, mass transit options. And, you know, the bill doesn't specifically identify all of what those projects will be, but it generates the revenue that we need in order to make that a reality.
Okay. And I'll ask your colleagues to weigh in, too. Dr. Blair, how do you see that?
Well, I want to start off by saying that mass transit actually was much better in previous days than it is now. You probably know that Rochester had a light rail system.
Oh, yeah.
Many mid-sized cities lost their mass transit because the auto companies actually bought up the mass transit companies and took them away because they didn't want the automobile industry being competed against. Now, the CCIA has a lot of provisions in it for the development of mass transit in mid-sized cities as well as large cities all across the state. And this is already being implemented as part of the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. So we're going to have better mass transit in this city as well as in other cities all across the state, not only within the cities, but between cities, as Liam pointed out.
Eric, how do you see mass transit in the future?
Well, the lack of mass transit in this country wasn't something that just came about accidentally. It was a choice. It was a matter of public policy, mm-hmm. in the same way that residential segregation was a matter of public policy. There are huge, some of them kind of hidden subsidies that car-oriented transportation receives in the form of zoning practices that encourage sprawl. And if we remove those implicit subsidies, we may get back to living patterns that are more favorable to mass transit, and I think everyone's lives would be better.
John Kievert, what do you think?
Well, the Climate and Community Investment Act explicitly talks about electrification of the transportation sector and explicitly mentions one of the important aspects is buses, and in particularly school buses. So right now, many of our school buses are diesel and have our kids riding on this bus that's spewing out particulates. So shifting over to electric school buses is strongly supported, and we need the money to do that as quickly as possible.
All right.
Speaking of money, I'd like to mention the cost. Gasoline prices vary. They're pretty volatile, up and down. They rose, 20 cents a gallon when there was a threat of a shortage that never occurred. If the companies fully transfer that 55 cents to consumers, it will put us up in a place that cost of gasoline where we've actually been before about a decade ago, and the economy did not fall apart. No mass riots. So I think that it's somewhat exaggerated to think we're gonna get into a crisis by implementing this. Canada has also implemented $40 a ton of carbon fee, and there was some pushback, but I believe it's going forward now. So it certainly can happen, and our folks are not going to be going to Canada to get cheap gas.
On the subject of EV cars, I don't know if it was Dr. Blair, one of the guests mentioned this, and David emails me to say, Evan, please have your guest clarify the statement that EVs do less damage to our roads than combustion vehicles. I can't see how that's possible when, for a comparable wheelbase and interior space, they're approximately 25 to 50% heavier. That's from David. I don't have a fact check on which cars are heavier, but that David's contention is that EVs tend to be heavier, and is wondering about the wear and tear on the infrastructure. I don't know if that was Dr. Blair. Alan, were you referring to that?
No, it was Eric.
Oh, Eric, very good. Eric, can you address that?
I think I was the one, and I was referring to the unburned hydrocarbons that fossil fuel vehicles emit, which are basically raining solvents down on the pavement, which can't be good for it.
Okay. Are you concerned about the weight of the vehicles?
That's potentially a concern. I don't think it's a concern in the long run, as battery energy densities are increasing, and battery electric vehicles are mechanically very simple. They're simpler than internal combustion vehicles. So I think in the long run, we're going to see the weights be comparable.
Maybe Emma Ray Stein, Megan Mack can help me with a quick fact check on the average weight of EVs versus non-EVs. But David, I appreciate that. And then Barbara emails on the subject of electric cars. And she says the following: obviously, cars are just part of this effort to reduce emissions and work on climate change, but electric cars are expensive, and millions of people cannot afford to buy one. How is this going to work? Is every home going to have a docking station in their driveway to power up the car battery? How much does that cost? What about people who may not have the ability to install one in their home? What if the electricity goes off? Can you charge up your car, or is it that you can't go anywhere until it comes back on? There are so many unanswered questions here. That's Barb in Wheatland. And I'm going to start with Liam on this one. But I think the undercurrent to Barb's email, which I think is fair, is that part of the work is going to have to be convincing the public that this is not a series of options for the elite, for people with money, for people who can afford certain things over others. That this is something that can be egalitarian, that this can be good for everybody. This doesn't just go and offer a benefit to those with the advantages already. Liam, what would you say to Barb?
Yeah, no, and I think it's important. I don't think no one's expecting, every person to buy an expensive electric car right away. That's wildly unrealistic. And I think the point of this bill, its strength is that by placing a fee on carbon, you unleash the market incentive to make affordable cars. It'll unleash a market incentive that helps in a lot of ways. But one thing is it'll incentivize the production of cars that everyday people can afford that are good for the environment. One other thing I think I add in that I think has been missing this throughout this conversation is the urgency of this. My generation and future generations will be disproportionately impacted by this. And I think what a lot of people don't realize is that, we're already seeing some impacts of climate change, but the longer we wait, the more my generation will suffer. And it's not just about, I think it's really important to have these conversations and think about this because we need to think about how we can make this a just world for my generation and future generations and not just people who are living right now.
Okay. John Kievert, what would you say to Barb in Wheatland?
Well, the price of a new electric car right now is fairly steep. Battery prices have been dropping dramatically and will continue to do so that will become more realistic. But very soon there will be used electric cars on the market. And I've been driving an electric car since 2013, and I purchased a used first-generation electric car that had dropped, I think, about 70% in value after the second year because the ranges became much longer and nobody wanted those. So I got it cheap, 2-year-old car for $12,000. So it's in the realm of realism that the market will cover that to make sure there are cars available for everyone.
Eric Koski?
Yeah. I went ahead and did a bit of research on this, and I made some head-to-head comparisons. The Nissan Leaf now sells for $25,000 new. Model year 2021, which is very comparable to what you would pay for a Honda Accord. The Hyundai Ioniq EV is about $27,000. So these are very much within reach for a lot of car buyers. And the price difference, to the extent that it persists, is becoming smaller all the time.
Alan Blair?
Hi. Barb, I just wanted to remind you and the rest of the viewers that lowering our carbon footprint is already the law of the land through CLCPA. And because of that, there's been a lot of research going on and a lot of discussion in Albany about this for the past couple of years. I've seen reports that show that as of now, the cost of owning a car the total cost of ownership of an electric car is about equal to the total cost of ownership of a gas car. The total cost of buying it is going to continually drop, and by the mid-2020s, the total cost of buying a car will drop below the cost of buying a gas car. The used car market is going to get better. There are going to be incentives by both the federal and the state government that will make buying an electric car cheaper. As far as buying the apparatus to charge the car goes, that's going to get cheaper too. And out on the road, there are going to be charging stations all over. This is going to be something that the state will be focusing very, very heavily on. The state is cognizant of the fact that right now it's a little bit difficult to charge a car, especially if it's not a Tesla. But that is going to change. So in the future, expect it to get as easy to charge a car both at home or in the parking lot outside your apartment, because that's going to happen too. There are going to be charging stations everywhere and not just for homeowners. I hope that helps.
Sure. And Irene from Walworth on the phone to follow that. Go ahead, Irene.
My question was, we're talking about using a lot of electricity. What's going to the source of the electricity going to be? Hopefully not coal-fired.
Sure. And Dr. Blair, do you want to you were just going there. I'll let you keep going if you want to address Irene's question there.
Absolutely. The Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act requires that all of our electricity be generated by renewable sources by 2040. In upstate, a significant portion of our electricity is already from renewable sources and from hydro, I guess, which is also a renewable source if you think about it. But the electricity is not going to be an issue for much longer. It's going to be totally clean. And so you don't have to worry about that.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Irene, thank you. But Dr. Blair, I mean, for the moment, you know, it's not as clean as we would like to be, or it's not as clean as it will be in the future, right?
That's true. But because electric vehicles are inherently more efficient than gasoline vehicles, even if you power up your car with electricity totally generated by fossil fuels, you still come out ahead.
So one other climate feature is the community choice aggregation. I live in Brighton, and 100% of our electricity, if we stay with the default, is from renewable sources, and in fact, it's even cheaper than RG&E's dirty energy. So it certainly can happen. There's many other communities that are joining the CCA. So it's very much going to be shifting over to totally renewable energy for most people in the near future.
All right. Let me ask all of our guests, maybe take about 30, 40 seconds apiece for anything that we didn't get to in this bill that you do want people to be thinking about. Liam, I'll start with you. Go ahead.
I think I just emphasize that, you know, this is a make polluters pay bill, but it's also a jobs bill that would create over 160,000 jobs in just 1 year. It's necessary to make sure we have a funding stream in order to achieve our ambitious climate goals of the CLCPA. And pricing carbon is one of the most efficient, effective, and quickest ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That we really need to make sure we get this done in order to protect my generation, future generations, minority communities, and, you know, the rest of New York from the effect of climate change.
Dr. Alan Blair.
I would say that the science is very clear on this, that climate change, if we do nothing, will lead to catastrophe, not just economic catastrophe, but environmental catastrophe. The costs will be enormous. I don't want my future to be that way. I don't want the future of my children or my grandchildren to be that way. And if you care about the people that come after you, you must support the CCAA or a bill like it.
John Kievert.
Well, I think we need to recognize we're in the midst of intersecting crises of climate, racism, COVID, and economic inequality. And I'm particularly passionate about passing the CCIA and working with New York Renews, which is a coalition of about 280 groups, businesses, faith groups, labor and justice groups, and environmental groups, who all commit to seeing that we have a just transition to a renewable energy economy, such that the people who have contributed the least to climate change and are now suffering the most are not further injured and basically come out ahead. There's strong prioritization of frontline communities for the new jobs, for training, and one-third of the money from the CCIA will, in fact, be given directly to community groups in the impacted areas to help with things like weatherization and, again, jobs training, improving the schools and other public buildings. So it's strong economic justice focus for CCIA.
And Eric Koski.
I'd like to make it clear that so much of the criticism of the bill is offered simply in bad faith. We know that Republican lawmakers are coached on how to talk about climate issues. They say everybody wants a stable climate. Everybody wants a cleaner environment. And then they offer specious objections to any realistic approach for achieving those. And so they really need to be called out for it. And there's a responsibility of journalists to call them out for it.
Well, I do appreciate that point, Eric. And you know, our goal is to only bring clear information and to clear it up when we think it is misinformation. And there's still, I think, a lot of work to be done on these issues. And I want to thank our guests, Eric Koski, owner and principal of Orbed Analytics, LLC, among other titles. Eric, thanks for making the time for the program today.
Thank you very much for having us.
And Dr. Ellen Blair, liaison to New York Renews from the Rochester chapter of CCL, Citizens Climate Lobby. Ellen, thank you for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
John Kievert, volunteer with New York Renews, among other titles. Thank you, John.
Appreciate the opportunity to get the honest word out.
And Liam Smith, co-director of governmental affairs for the New York Youth Climate Leaders. Thank you, Liam.
Thanks for having me.
From the whole team here, have a great afternoon, and we will talk with you tomorrow.